Hey there. Welcome back to What's Up. This is the podcast where I discuss the Chris Watts murder case. Thank you so much for joining today. I'm so happy to have you with me. Even if you're not with me, it feels like you are. So thank you again. And thank you so much for all of your comments and feedback. It is sincerely appreciated. I read every single comment, good, bad, or ugly. It doesn't matter. Please keep them coming. Let me know how I'm doing. It is incredibly appreciated. So thank you for that. In this episode, I want to talk about something that's been on my mind for a long time, and that is narratives. So I feel like something I didn't really realize for most of my life, but now I really realize it, especially considering the state of the world today. So I feel like everything in the world, everything in politics, everything in media, everything in everything is basically a narrative. And there is no real objective truth. No, there is and there isn't. But a lot of what happens, a lot of what we interpret, does tend to be subjective and not objective. So a little bit about myself. I grew up in New York. I'm an East Coaster. I'm in a blue state. I'm a liberal. And for most of my life, I've considered myself to be a liberal. I felt very comfortable with this and that my views were those that are sort of universally correct. And I realize that's not the case now, but I always assumed it and couldn't really be challenged. And that anyone who thought differently than I thought, you know, they just must be wrong. Right? So I'm proud of my heritage, my geographical location, my views. I feel like this is a good way to be, a good way to think. But I also realize that I'm very much a product of my environment, my region, my family, my heritage, my culture, my friends, my family. Everything that I think and believe is shaped by my environment. So my beliefs are not unlike everyone else I've known my entire life. And these are reinforced through my friend group and my family and where I live. And I just assume that these are 100% correct. It never occurred to me that there was anything wrong with the way that I thought or anything might be worth challenging. I just took it for granted that how I thought, how my friends and family thought, and how everyone in the East Coast, how we all collectively sort of thought, is the American way of thinking. This is the right way to think, and, you know, I'm good with that. But I will say that in the last 4 years, I started thinking, and I won't mention his name, but I will say that someone took occupancy in the White House, and from day one, he started talking about fake news 1,000 times over. Every 10 seconds, he would talk about the news media and how all of it is fake. Now, it is kind of ironic that someone like himself would be so consumed with saying how other people, other entities are fake and deceptive and use lies. It is kind of ironic, okay? But the one thing I couldn't ignore after hearing this repeatedly over and over and over again, how CNN and NBC and all this stuff and how they're just fake and they're lying and blah, 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 you know, it never occurred to me that that could ever even be remotely possible. But if you hear this enough, if you hear these things enough, eventually it does get through and you start to get curious, as I did. So eventually, after hearing this for maybe 3 or so years, I decided one day to sort of tiptoe over to what I considered to be the dark side. And I started to get out of my bubble just a little bit, long enough to listen to what the other guy has to say. And boy, was I shocked. I mean, I was enlightened. I came to learn that there is also, within the United States, an extremely large group of people who think completely differently than I do, completely differently than anyone I know does. So I started to listen to them, and I started to broaden my perspective just a little bit and include other points of view. And I'm not talking about shock jocks. I'm not talking about extremists. I'm not talking about fringe or QAnon. I'm talking about just conservative media. And it was an eye-opener. I mean, I feel like, in a way, to challenge myself this way and just kind of go against my own personal grain, it was sort of enlightening. Now, I realize that we as a society, we can breathe the same air, share the same sun and the same moon, and yet have a completely different view of the world. And that's normal. There's nothing wrong with that. But one thing that I did learn is that just because I feel I'm right, that doesn't necessarily mean someone else is wrong, right? It just means that they have a different point of view than I do. So I will say that after this experiment of going to the other side, I was not red-pilled, as they say, but I realized I definitely had spent my life being blue-pilled without even questioning it. I just assumed that this was the right way to go. And I completely went along with it without questioning it, without thinking about it, without even challenging it, even remotely. So I realized that those who think differently than me are not wrong, bad, crazy, or any other negative traits you might associate with the other, someone who's unlike me, right? So they just see things differently than I do, and I can respect that. So I realized that how we see things, as I said before, is not necessarily objective, but more subjective. So this enabled me to sort of open myself up a little bit more and perhaps try, if I can, to avoid being on a side, one side or the other, but try to use objectivity to make up my own mind and see information that comes to me, and then I can decide what I think about it. So I literally went through a period of listening to liberal media for my entire life, and then I spent an entire year listening to conservative media, and I decided then I'm just not going to listen to any of it. I quit. I stopped. And it was incredibly liberating. I'm not saying that you should do that. I'm not even encouraging that. I'm just saying that it's an eye-opener to realize that how you think and how I think is not objective truth. Okay? So, as I was saying, I feel like both liberal and conservative media, they use narratives and storytelling, and these stories, they compete with each other vociferously. I just wanted to say vociferously. I've never even said that word before. People love a good story, and I love a good story. I think it's an ideal, perfect way to make your point because your listener is so engaged in what you're saying. It's so much more entertaining to hear a story rather than just hearing what happened. You want to hear a story. You want it to be enhanced, embellished. It's much more interesting. That's just how stories are. And the stories we hear in the media, they are narratives, and you kind of have to follow that narrative. You have to follow the entire thing. You can't just take one piece. You have to take the entire thing, okay? So oftentimes I find that the more absurd, the more ludicrous, the more extreme the story is, I mean, can someone say lizard people? The more ridiculous, the more you're going to max out the number of people who are actually following this story. So you're going to have eyeballs on it because it's fascinating. It's interesting. You're not necessarily delivering facts. You are, because facts are boring. But it's more like you're delivering a fantasy, a virtual idea. And that way people are actually paying attention. And I think it's a good way to, I think it's dishonest, but I think it's an effective way to engage people. So there's a movie I watched when I was in college. I took a film class, and we had to watch a movie called Rashomon. So Rashomon is a Japanese film. So Here's a description. So, brimming with action while incisively examining the nature of truth. Rashomon is perhaps the finest film to ever investigate the philosophy of justice. Through an ingenious use of camera and flashbacks, Kurosawa reveals the complexities of human nature as four people recount different versions of the story of a man's murder and the rape of his wife. So there's this thing called the Rashomon effect, because it's a famous movie, and the point of the movie is, as I said, it's kind of like eye of the beholder. So the Rashomon effect is a term that relates to the notorious unreliability of eyewitnesses. It describes a situation where an event is given contradictory interpretations or descriptions by the individuals involved. So basically, everyone's seeing and experiencing the same thing, and they're viewing the same thing, but are they? Because when they recount the story, their interpretation of the story is going to be completely different. So it's not like it's objective. Everyone sees what they see based on their own personal biases, based on where they grew up, their family history, what they believe, their opinions. All of this is going to shape their takeaway. It's not like they're lying. This is how they see it. So I think that this is a good time to segue back to our favorite supervillain, Chris Watts. Okay, because that's what this is all about, Chris Watts. So in terms of what we do know about this story, okay, so what we know for sure, you know, Oprah has a thing, what do we know for sure? Okay, so what we know for sure, absent of any embellishment or conspiracy, Chris did confess to killing Shanann and the kids. I'm not making this up. He did. He didn't just do this one time under intense questioning and duress, but he did this again in very specific detail in an hours-long interview post-sentencing. No one was holding a gun to his head. He wasn't coerced. He didn't have to talk, but he did voluntarily. He gave a very long description of how he did it. He wasn't under any legal obligation to talk. Quite frankly, people have questioned why he talked, and that the detectives who came to visit him in prison, they sort of ambushed him, didn't give him a chance to think about it, share it with his family, or talk to a lawyer. And if he had, they probably would have talked him out of it, and I'm sure the detectives knew this. So, fair or not, he did spill the beans, and he did tell us what happened on the night in question. We also know that he did not fight for a trial, and he pled guilty. Who does that? He never shouted from the rooftops, "I didn't do it, I didn't do it, I didn't do it, it was Shanann, it was Shanann, it was Shanann. She did it." He made the claim just one time. He made the claim that Shanann killed the daughters, but this was only as a result of what's called the Reed technique. So the Reed technique is a psychological system which was developed in the U.S. by John Reed in the 50s. He was a psychologist, a polygraph expert, and a former Chicago police officer. So the proponents of the Reed technique say it is useful in extracting information from otherwise unwilling suspects. However, critics of the technique, they say it results in an unacceptably high rate of false confessions, especially from juveniles. Okay, so that's fine. Chris himself is not a juvenile. He's an adult male. So they use this technique on him, famously, as Tammy floated the possibility. So basically what they do is they give you an acceptable narrative, and they hope that you're going to take this narrative, and it's more of a soft landing. They give you a chance to say something, admit something, not the full thing, but a piece of it. And that way, hopefully, they can get you all the way to the confession, the full confession. Because they know they're not going to get you from 0 to 60. So they want to get you from 0 to 20. So they say, Chris, did Shanann do something, and then you felt you had to do something back to her? So that's the Reed technique. They're giving him a false narrative. They're saying, we're on your side. We would understand. Chicks are crazy. Chicks do crazy things. Well, you can tell us. We know chicks are crazy. And then Chris is like, thinks about this for a second, and he's like, yeah. So he completely accepts this as a logical theory of what of a logical account of what happened, not a theory. And he goes for it. And this enables them to get closer to the full confession. Okay, but initially he did say that it was Shanann who killed the kids. He held on to this for a while, but he did not continue to hold on to this, because if he had, he might not be in jail right now. He might be, he'd be in jail, but he'd be awaiting a trial. So he didn't go that route, okay? If you watch Chris's initial confession, I feel like, in my humble opinion, them using this read technique on him was like taking candy from a baby. So he was so desperate for a narrative that would let him continue to be a good guy and let him off the hook. And in this narrative, he gets to be the hero. Because even though the kids are already dead, he's trying to save them. He wants to save them. So he wants to pull the evil Shanann off the kids so that he can save them. But they're already gone. But at least in his story, he's a good guy. Okay? So he likes that story because I think he identifies as a good guy. So he took the bait. And that's the point. So, they gave him a soft landing, as I said, something he could confess to in the hopes that, this will get you to the big fish, right? So confessing to triple homicide, to your wife and unborn baby, that's not something that someone's going to give up so fast. They needed baby steps, and that's what they took. So that's how they got him to the confession, the full confession. But make no mistake, he did fully confess. So there are those out there who say, no, he did fully confess. But this is really the only time he tried to pin it on Shanann. He did for a while, so it wasn't like the only time, but he kind of let that go pretty quickly. So if he was truly innocent, I mean, quite frankly, we all know he would have fought it. If he was innocent, he didn't do it. You think he's just going to, like, walk into jail for the rest of his life and say, okay, you got me, put the cuffs on me? No, of course he's going to fight it. He said, even to the officers when they visited him, he said that my lawyers would have said anything for me. I didn't want them to lie for me for 2 years. So, like, he knew that. He knew they would have created a story, a backstory to try to get him off, And honestly, like in the American legal system, you have to prove someone guilty beyond a reasonable doubt to get a conviction. So it's not that easy to do. Even if you have a smoking gun, you've got bodies, you still have to prove it to a jury that it's beyond a reasonable doubt. So I assume that if he had gone the legal route, he would have had his legal team try to create some sort of smoke and mirrors and allude to the idea that a dead woman could have done this, and then not being able to disprove this. So that's reasonable doubt. He would get off. Look at Casey Anthony. So, he didn't go this route. He didn't say... He even said to the detectives, I didn't want them to lie to me, for however long a trial would have taken. So, using logic, if this was an actual true thing, a wrong man accused facing life in prison, you wouldn't just say this a million times. You wouldn't just say, I didn't do it, and just as many times as you need to say it. You would fight, of course. You tell me, you would fight. If you're legitimately innocent, you would fight. You're not just going to lay down and take it. So I know there are some who say that he took this deal because somewhere in his mind and heart, he still loved Shanann and he wanted to protect her. Okay, so remember in the interview, he says, I don't want to protect her. Like he was saying how, like, I'm tired of protecting. I did protect her, but I'm done doing that. I don't want to protect her. So, again, as I said in another episode, it was kind of unclear. Who are you talking about? You're talking about Shanann, you're talking about Nicole. Who is it that you don't want to protect, who you were previously protecting? I don't want to protect her. And that was really mysterious to me. I still don't know who he was referring to, but he said, I don't want to protect her. And as though he's protecting her from, being a known killer. And to this I say, really? He's not protecting Shanann. By this point, he's already having an affair with another woman he was crazy about. So you're telling me that at this point, he's going to protect his wife and throw himself on the sword for Shanann, even though he's already decided in his mind he doesn't love her anymore and he's with somebody else, why would he do that? That doesn't make any sense. He's going to take a deal and go to jail forever to protect his wife he was cheating on? No, I don't buy it, okay? So, as I said before, narratives. So, you know, there are kind of two teams going on right now, as there are, I think, with everything, as I've noticed over the past several years. There's always, like, two concurrent narratives, and you just have to decide which one you're going to go with. And, you know, use whatever resources you have available to you and try to figure out what is real and what is true, what is false. So, as I've seen through my own observations, there's Team Shanann and there's Team Chris still. So, despite Chris's very lengthy and detailed confession, there are still people out there who believe that Chris is innocent, that he didn't do it, and he's wrongly convicted. So, here's the claim. Chris is a good guy, falsely accused of being forced to confess to something he did not do. In Chris's version of the events, he is the hero who, yes, he confessed to killing Shanann, but only because he saw her on top of Cece, and he freaked out. So any jury who heard this, maybe they would have mercy on the man who killed someone, who killed someone because they saw someone else killing the kids that he loved. Maybe they'd go easy on him, right? I mean, if he's a good guy. So then the claim is he was railroaded. He didn't get to speak with his parents enough to have them, you know, give him advice. He didn't get proper counsel. They kept him from his parents, and then he was making one bad decision after the other. And to this I say, bullshit, you're a grown man, make your own decisions. You know, he could have made plenty of decisions. They made it seem like they pressured him so much that he agreed to anything, and he was just like a little boy, and he's not old enough to make his own adult decisions. But he's in his 30s. He's not a child. He can make decisions. They asked him to do a polygraph, and what did they say? They said, would you do a polygraph? You know what he said? Sure. Sure. Okay. That doesn't exactly sound like pressure to me. Apparently, he's the one person on Earth who's never seen any shows about police or a single episode of Law and Order and unfamiliar with Miranda rights. You know, everyone knows Miranda rights. If you're 5 years old, you know Miranda rights. You have the right to remain silent. You have the right to an attorney. If you cannot afford an attorney, the state will provide one for you. He's never heard that before. So he doesn't get an attorney, and he just volunteers to tell, you know, talk to police and agrees to a polygraph. Okay? You know, either that or perhaps he was, I mean, more than likely he was perhaps worried how, if he were to be demanding to, you know, refuse a polygraph and get a lawyer, how this would appear, the optics of this. So, like, from the police's point of view, they don't want him to get a lawyer. They don't want him to lawyer up. And he doesn't want to get a lawyer because he doesn't want it to look bad for him. He doesn't want to make it look like he's guilty. And who gets lawyers? Guilty people. So maybe that's why he used that strategy. I mean, I think it's a bad strategy, but that's what he used. Okay? So there are people out there circulating this other story that Chris is innocent and he deserved a trial and he never got a trial, as though he didn't have this option. But he did have the option for a trial. He waived that. So it's not like they denied him a trial. He said, I don't want a trial. So I don't know why people are saying, well, he didn't get a trial. He could have had a trial. He didn't want it. So also the claim, the narrative, also strongly suggests that even if Chris did plan and do all of this, even if he did everything he was accused of and found guilty of, he's still somehow innocent. Because it was the evil Shanann who drove him to do all of this. He was just at her mercy. He was only reacting to her. She pushed him towards this, and he had no choice. Okay? So that's what people say, and that's patently ridiculous. So however they try and spin it, at the end of the day, Chris is not guilty. Whether he killed Shanann and the kids, or he just killed Shanann, he's not a guilty man, regardless of what he confesses to. He is an innocent victim and a hero at that. Okay? And then there's the narrative that Shanann is the real monster. So people suggest that she was a fraud. She never actually had lupus. And it was just a ploy to sell Thrive. Right? So she's trying to make the claim that Thrive helped her back to wellness and relieved her chronic pain. And it was because of this this wellness product, these patches, that she was able to feel well. Well, I believe that, you know, supplements and patches and whatever, they could give you some good feelings, and maybe they do feel make you feel good. But you're saying that she just made up this whole story? And then another story is that she and Nicole weren't actually selling Thrive because they weren't making a big profit off of that, but actually they were dealing OxyContin. And that's what were in the storage containers in Shanann's basement. That the two of them were running a drug ring. I mean, the story gets crazier and crazier and crazier. Okay. Then there's the idea that the kids never actually had any real medical problems. So not only Shanann was faking her medical problems, but it was also all a fraud. And all of her Thrive friends and her family and everyone was just in on it. It was just some massive conspiracy. Her medical team would have to be in on it too, because they would have to all be on board that she was just making up these fake problems that the kids had and having an EpiPen and all these medications and medical procedures. They're just made up. Now, I'm not going to say it's not impossible. There is such a thing as Munchausen's syndrome, where you fake illnesses, right? There was the case of Gypsy Rose Blanchard, and horrible, horrible story. That does happen. But Shanann was not that person. She was not that mom of Gypsy who was a nutcase, okay? They say her house in North Carolina was purchased and it was ill-gotten gain. That's how she was able to buy it. And she had to leave it in a hurry. And, you know, I don't know about that. Okay. There are people who say, oh, well, Shanann was a bad person. All her friends were from Thrive. Like, this is somehow sinister. Like, her only friends, no one liked her. All her friends were from Thrive. And to me, I say, well, she was fairly new to Colorado. She'd only been there a few years. And she made friends through work. So that's how people make friends. I don't know why that is, like, sinister somehow, okay? Then there's the claim that maybe Shanann, the baby Shanann was carrying, wasn't Chris's. I mean, you can go through every single thing and pull it apart and say, oh, this is suspicious, this is suspicious. It's been claimed that Shanann dosed the kids with Benadryl at night, nightly, so that she could have free time for herself. Like, it was very selfish of her. No, I don't know. That she put her kids to bed too early. I mean, kids that age go to bed really early. They do. That's what they do. So, who knows? Then there is that Shanann is evil because she insulted Chris on Facebook. There was a whole thing with the Santa thing. And she sarcastically says, my husband's a genius, where actually what she meant was her husband's an idiot. And to this I say, have you ever seen King of Queens? Everyone Loves Raymond. All in the Family. There's like 1,000 TV shows with husbands and wives where they insult each other on a regular basis. That is just normal. Maybe it's mean. It's normal. It happens. It doesn't mean anything sadistic about her. My God. Okay. Then there's the thing that she's like super controlling because she would never allow him to even hang a picture frame. And to this I say, big whoop. So hang a picture frame. Tell her, hey, I don't need your input. I can do this on my own. Like, what are you bitching about, okay? And then the last one, there's so many more, but then the last one is that she was completely drunk when she came home that night at 2 a.m. She was, and that's why she did it. That's why this fight started. That's why this thing went down. That's why it's believable that she killed the kids. I'm sorry. I can be blitzed on tequila and Jägermeister, which is technically liquid heroin, and still not murder my kids. Now, we all saw the video of her coming up to her house. She looked perfectly fine. Doesn't mean she wasn't drunk. It doesn't mean she was, but she definitely wasn't stumbling. She didn't look like she was a mess. She just looked normal, okay? But even if she was drunk, what does that prove? Nothing. Zero. Okay? All right. So then there are those who are on Team Shanann. And this is a, you know, there's a ton of people out there. It's like, if you say one single bad thing about Shanann, whoa, baby, they will, like, pile on you, okay? And I totally understand that. I mean, look, she was killed. She was brutally murdered. It's a horrible thing. And you don't want to victim blame, and you don't want to say bad things about her. And I'm sure, okay, so let's just go to Team Shanann. So from her friend's point of view, she was highly beloved, very well loved within this group. She was absolutely a perfect angel. She was a wonderful mother. She could do no wrong. She absolutely was beloved by everybody. Anyone who criticizes her is just victim blaming, and they're just jealous or whatever it is. And, you know, and I agree, that is a horrendous thing to do, to kind of, to blame her a little bit, considering the horrible fate that she suffered. You know, even after this murder, if you even found out that she didn't separate her, her trash, her recycled trash into the right bins, I'd say, you know, just keep it to yourself. To them, I think she was sort of a legend, not a legend, but she was sort of a superstar. She was doing very well in the MLM business, making decent money. She not only nailed it as a direct sales rep for this MLM company, that's really hard to do, but she was actually able to practically cure her lupus and other chronic medical conditions by using this wellness patch. And felt it was sort of her calling to pay it forward and help others who may be in a similar predicament. You know, some say, oh, she was exploiting them. I say, you know, if it worked for her, then she wanted to pass it on to others. You know, people think that making money is somehow like a dirty thing, like we don't all need it and want it and try to attain it. So she was just trying to get money, like everybody else. You know, she kept a beautiful home. She took meticulous care of her house and her children. And, you know, according to her friends and family, she pretty much could do no wrong. There was absolutely nothing wrong with her. She was perfect in every way. She was almost mythical. I don't say that to mock. I'm saying that that's kind of the perception of those who are on Team Shanann. So what, in my opinion, I think that the versions of these narratives, you know, they diverge dramatically. And I feel like if you really want to know what the truth is, I think it just lies somewhere in between. And it's kind of boring, actually. You know, the truth is boring. You know, the story is much more entertaining and interesting, and that's what keeps people coming back and pulling apart this and pulling apart that and just kind of going over it and finding the minutia and the details and saying, what does this mean? What does that mean? And that seems pretty suspicious. So what is the boring truth? I think the boring truth lies somewhere in the middle. It's somewhere in between fact and fiction. Albeit, of course, we know the truth is very boring. It's never as fascinating as a scandal, you know? So what's the boring truth? Well, beginning with the relationship between Shanann and Chris and the mother-in-law slash monster-in-law who doesn't like her daughter-in-law-to-be and doesn't go to the wedding. Is this a scandal? No, it happens. Mother-in-laws and daughter-in-laws, I mean, it's like the oldest story in the book, them not getting along. Does that make Cindy evil? No. Is it possible she had a good reason for not liking Shanann? Yeah, it is possible. I don't know what that reason is, but it's possible. Was it rational and reasonable and fair-minded? Well, I guess it just depends on her experience with her daughter-in-law and what she sees as rational and fair-minded. And maybe it wasn't. Maybe she was completely unreasonable and her expectations were off the charts ridiculous. Only they really know what the dynamic of that relationship was, you know? But I think that the idea that a mother-in-law doesn't like her daughter-in-law is not at all uncommon or unusual, okay? I think it's also boring to say that in no way on earth do I believe that she, meaning Cindy, is happy her son killed his wife. I think she's probably horrified by this. But I also think that it's much more entertaining to paint her as evil, as though she's wringing her hands and saying, ooh, ha, 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 I'm so glad you killed that woman. You know, I hated her to begin with. You know, That's more fascinating, but I sincerely doubt that to be the truth. But I will say, in fairness, I think that Cindy, being that she had a contentious relationship with Shanann, for her to then go out publicly and talk about how upset she is over this, would also, she'd be pounced on for that too. So it's really a no-win situation. She can talk about how, you know, how sad it is, how awful it is, but to say that she just loves Shanann so much would just be, you know, would not even be true. It would be, you know, it would make her a hypocrite. And I think that she was really in a no-win situation in that scenario. As far as Nicole Kessinger is concerned, there's like a billion people who think that she was involved. I don't know whether she was or not. I don't know if she's an accomplice. I don't know if they just kind of let her off easy. I would say this. I would say the boring truth is that she's one of millions of people who got involved with the married man, who swore up and down that he was on his way to being divorced. And she bought it. In my humble opinion, I think the only thing she's legit guilty of is just being incredibly naive. I think that's her biggest problem, is that she's naive and she believed him. If a man is saying he's getting divorced, it will be very obvious. He'll leave clues. You'll be able to know. So I think that she was naive. If she was involved, I hope that they go after her. I don't think she was, but I can't rule it out. I can't say either way. I've heard people say that they would love for Chris to get a trial so that the public can finally get to the truth and put all the rumors, conspiracies, and speculation to rest once and for all. To this I say, bullshit. I'm not buying that. I think a trial would be a hold my beer situation. I think that people would love the idea of a trial because they would get more of this story and it would be more salacious and exciting and dramatic. It would open up a whole other chapter of YouTubers and Redditors and podcasters and books and articles and media blitz and all this craziness. And it would just keep people on this story until the end of time. I don't think a trial would put anything to rest. I don't think anyone who believes what they believe is suddenly going to go ahead and change their beliefs to something else. I think how they believe and what they believe will only be reinforced if a trial were to actually happen. And at this stage, it seems very, very, very unlikely, almost impossible. Okay? But I think that a trial would just fan the flames and keep this story going until the end of time. So just to wrap up, you know, Rudy Giuliani, who was America's mayor after 9/11, and then he went a little bit batty, I have to say. And he started saying all kinds of crazy stuff in interviews on the media. You know, maybe, who knows, maybe it's his age. I don't really know. But he did say in an interview something which was incredibly controversial and people really had a very hard time with it. It was when someone said, the truth is the truth. I think he was on CNN. I don't remember what the station was. Truth is, he says, the truth is not the truth. And the reporter was like, what? The truth is not the truth. This is what he swore. The truth is not the truth. And everyone was just aghast. How could you say the truth is not the truth? The truth most certainly is the truth because the truth is the truth. That's what the truth is, truth. And everyone just thought Rudy had just like lost his mind and how could he say it? And these are the ramblings of a crazy person with dementia. And I say, no, I don't agree. I totally got what, I couldn't even say I'm a fan. I mean, I'm not defending him. I'm saying I get what he means. The truth is not the truth. A lot of what you hear and what you see is spin. It's lies. It's narratives. It's storytelling. It's trying to create a point or get people to side with you. It's not necessarily truth. Now, truth is a hard thing to come by, and it can be very painful. You know, you think of movies like, there's two movies that come to mind, that the demand for the truth. It's very hard to get to, okay? So you think of a movie where the main character demands that someone else who is deceiving them tells the truth. So this is often very heated and highly dramatic. I think of the movie Pretty in Pink, where this is Andy, and she had been invited to go to the prom and with Blaine. And then he sort of, like, blows her off. And she doesn't understand why. So she's like very, 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 very upset by this. And she kind of knows that he's blowing her off because she's not good enough to be with him. And she confronts him and she says, just say it. Just say it. Tell me the truth. Tell me the truth. Tell me the truth. And she's like screaming at him and cursing him. Tell me the truth. You're ashamed to be seen with me. You're ashamed to go out with me. Just say it. Just tell me the fucking truth. He's very heated, you know. And he, of course, lies to her and tells her, oh, you know, I asked someone else, but I forgot about it, you know. And she just goes bananas. And she calls him a filthy fucking no good liar and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, so that's very heated, you know. And then I think of course, famously, the movie A Few Good Men. You can't handle the truth. That's like the iconic line. You know, it's hard to get to the objective truth. It's painful. It's uncomfortable. And it makes people cringe, you know? That's just how it is. So I think the problem in general with narratives is that you have to buy one idea or the other. You can't just, like, pick and choose the parts that you like. You have to buy the whole car. So there's no, like, nuance, and you're not allowed to look at other people's perspectives. So in a situation like this, with the Watts tragedy, or even most situations, I think if you legitimately want to know the truth and the whole truth, the whole story, you have to zoom out and look at it in its entirety. You can't just look at it through the lens of, I'm on Team Chris, I'm on Team Shanann, I'm on Team this, Team that. If you were to say something about Shanann, it's not a victim blame, nor is it to give Chris a free pass for what he did. If from a historical perspective you have an interest in knowing the full story, you have to be somewhat scientific and break it down and go piece by piece by piece. And I think personally, somewhere in the middle, that's where the truth is going to lie. It's not going to be on either side. So, what I think was actually happening. So, this to me is the truth of the story. And this is my interpretation. I'm not saying this is the interpretation. I'm saying this is how I see it. And it's boring. What was actually happening? Shanann and Chris bought a gigantic house that they couldn't afford. From the get-go, they couldn't afford it. Their monthly expenses way exceeded how much money they were bringing in, okay? So their entire life was pretty much a house of cards, and it was kind of getting ready to collapse, okay? So this is common knowledge. Their finances were a disaster. And adding a baby to this situation, even though this may be something that they both wanted, Chris wanted a boy baby, was really going to be the final Jenga piece. You know, you're going to take a piece out of the Jenga tower and it's just going to all fall. So their beautiful life that Nicole Kessinger was sort of admiring, and she said in an email to Chris, she said, I want something like what you have and your beautiful life, which she was admiring, didn't really even exist. I mean, they had this nice life, but they were in financial devastation. So their life was really built on quicksand. And it was probably, you know, I think Nicole had asked Chris if he thought it was sustainable. And he said no. And he knew that. So the next part is they spent way, way too much money. And they lived way above their means. But here's the thing. The key word here is they. They lived above their means. It was not she who lived above their means. They did. He was upset that she spent too much money or she mismanaged money. Hello, how about you step in and stop being such a wuss? You're the husband. Take part in what's going on in your home. You know, maybe stop going on expensive vacations and going on spending sprees. You're telling me that she did all of this and he just went along for the ride and didn't say anything, but he's going to blame her for it? Give me a break. They're a married couple. So that I don't buy. Of course, Shanann liked to have nice things, but the idea that she put them in financial ruin as though he had nothing to do with it, give us all a break. So, as I said, everything reminds me of a movie. It's like the end of the movie Goodfellas when the FBI says to Henry and Karen, says, Karen, don't give me that babe in the woods act. we hear you on those wiretaps. You know, in this scenario, Chris is Karen Hill. You know, he was right there beside her as she supposedly wrecked their financial life, and he was enjoying it all along. Give us a break. It takes two to tango. It always does. So for him to blame her for this is just ridiculous. Okay. Shanann, you know, she had chronic pain for many years. So what's the most logical reality? That she was perpetrating a fraud all along for years, and all her family and friends, they were all on board with it? Or maybe she was a hypochondriac. Or maybe she had Munchausen syndrome. But which is more likely? Isn't it more likely that she legitimately had serious health conditions and that was honest? The idea that she faked an illness herself and faked illnesses of her own children just to get attention or to make money by getting sympathy from, you know, buyers of her product, that her entire story is just that, a story, she faked it all just to make sales? Is this impossible? No, it's not impossible. People do stuff like this all the time. But ask yourself, is it likely? Is it sustainable? Over time, you would have to do a tremendous amount of work to sustain this narrative, to perpetuate it over a series of years. It would be next to impossible. So she'd either have to be extremely convincing, or she would need co-conspirators, including Chris, her friends, her family, physicians. They'd all have to be in on it. And what would be their motivation? Really? Why? So then there's Netgate. So what's the truth about that? Well, given that the kids had severe nut allergies, yes, I think it was incredibly irresponsible for her in-laws to fail to be proactive and protect the kids from these, you know, these things that would be in their house that could make them sick. Now, this sparked World War III. Shanann stormed out of the house, told Chris she was not comfortable bringing her kids to see her in-laws, their grandparents, and that he should side with her and take his balls out of his pocket and stand up to his parents once and for all. But here's the thing. In reality, nothing actually happened. Not Cece and not Bella got exposed to allergens. Neither of them got sick. The kids were fine. But it blew up nonetheless. And something like this within a family dynamic can just turn into, an explosion. Huge, you know? This is something you don't recover from. The idea that her in-laws were trying to kill her children, like, and the fact that she accused them of this, like, this is war, okay? There's no turning back from that. So in my humble opinion, I think there was a small scintilla of a possibility that Cindy felt that Shanann was exaggerating about the kids' allergies and maybe she was trying to trap her. But, you know, that's pretty awful. I don't know if that's the case, and I don't want to make that claim or even accuse that. I'm just going to say that that is a possibility. But I'm just saying, in terms of this Nutgate, I think it was just one of those things. It was a misunderstanding, and it blew up. But that's what happens, you know? As far as whether or not Shanann was bitchy or bossy or controlling, you know, I can see that she may have been. I mean, not necessarily, as her friend Nicole Atkinson said, in a bad way. She just wanted to push people to do more, to do better. She was very meticulous. I know women like her. Like, she wanted things to be a certain way because she felt that her way was good. Not for evil, but for good. I can see that over time, Chris may have found this to be initially exciting and a turn-on, and then eventually become tiresome and feel like he's being controlled and he just wants to get out. But I don't file this in the category of abuse by her. And to be honest, when asked in prison about Shanann, Chris reaffirmed that she was a good mother and a good wife. Like, he says that freely. He doesn't bash her at all. Like, what's his motivation to say nice things about her? He killed her, and he admitted to killing her. But he says that she was a good person. So, clearly he lost his mind the night of the murders, but he does acknowledge the truth about Shanann, that she was indeed a good person. So maybe all these people who were trying to say that she was a horrible person should take that into account. You know, and then there's the idea that she had a sketchy past. Well, I would say, who the hell doesn't have a few skeletons in their closet? It's much easier to judge someone from the sidelines. She may or may not have made some questionable decisions in her life. This we do not know for sure. There's no whistleblower who's really come forward to say who and what she really was, and you're going to kind of get the real story. So you have to just rely on friends and family, most of whom say she was a wonderful mother, daughter, and friend. To those who are deeply upset at the notion that they had no money but were living large on credit or on borrowed money or wherever they got this money from, I ask this question. What bothers you more? The fact that they appeared to be living so well, or that it was a house of cards ready to collapse? Or do you feel it's unfair that they get to live so well, but you don't get to live as well? I don't live as well. Not even close. So is it like you resent them because they were living in a way that you would want to live? Or you kind of castigate them because they were perpetrating some sort of fraud of a very beautiful life together? You know, it's a good question. So my key takeaway from this incredibly messy and scandalous story is that in reality, it's, you know, kind of boring when you really think about it. So a man, I mean, I know it doesn't seem like it's boring, but it is. A man is married. He gets a 7-year itch. He looks to find a girlfriend to scratch his itch. They have a nice home. They're living deeply in debt, far from uncommon. They've got severe financial pressures. Maybe they're on the verge of losing their house. They do have another baby on the way, which is going to only exacerbate their already disastrous financial problems. On top of this, the baby will, of course, jeopardize his relationship with Nicole, and he probably would have to end it. So I think that Chris was at the end of his rope, and he wanted out. Now, because Chris was docile, friendly, mild-mannered, no history of violence or crime in his life, it was either a major snap, or it was some sort of a psychological episode, or drug-induced event that came and went. In my humble opinion, I think if he had a time machine and could go back in time and do it all again, I don't think he would. I can't say that for sure, but I don't think he would. As for the sadistic nature of the crime itself, the oil tanks, and the horror and gruesomeness that is all associated with this crime, someone else mentioned, and I agree, that he did not come up with this idea to put them in the tanks as a last-minute idea of, like, oh, my God, what do I do with these bodies? I don't think he just was like, oh, gee, you know what, this would work. I think that was a plan, and I think he had it in mind. And someone I had communicated with, they said, you know what, I bet every time he was looking at those tanks, he was thinking, gee, I bet my kids would fit in here. And I think that's a strong possibility. He worked for Anadarko for a long time. He knew the size and the shape of the tanks and the contents inside. He knew the circumference of the hatches, and I imagined it was well ingrained in his mind as a solid place to hide bodies, because the oil itself would just dissolve their bodies, and that would be the end of them. So no body, no crime. I don't think that he walked up those stairs with Bella and Celeste and was just going to kind of test drive and see if they would fit inside, but maybe they wouldn't fit inside. I think he knew for sure they were going to fit inside. So that alone, that's not boring. It's sick. It's horrifying. So I'm not saying that it's in itself is a boring aspect of this crime. It's disgusting. I say this premeditation, you know, it's horrifying. It's very dramatic. But even so, without giving the impression that I give him the slightest amount of latitude, I still think what he did, I still see it as depraved, sadistic, disgusting, I mean, horrifying. But I do think that in terms of, like, storytelling, I think it could be boiled down to what Special Agent Graham Coder said. And this is what he said. He said, here's what I see. You're looking pretty fit. You lost a lot of weight. What I see is you met a hot new girlfriend, and you decided you wanted to have a new life. And in order to have a new life, you had to get rid of the old life. And that's exactly what he did. Although I'm not done talking about this case, in my humble opinion, that is the truth at its core. That he saw something else that he wanted, so he had to get rid of the first thing. I think it's as simple as that. I think the idea of a planned demolition, explosion, and all of these crazy conspiracies, and that Shanann was just faking lupus, and the kids didn't actually have allergies, and all this stuff, I think that's just, it's just a story. You know, I don't think it's really grounded in reality or truth. I could be wrong, and I'm open to that. I'm just saying that I think, as horrible as this story is, I think it's an old story, and it's a story that's been told many times throughout history. It's a very sad story, but I don't think it's as complicated or dramatic. What's the word I'm looking for? I don't think it's as complicated as we make it out to be. Okay. Well, those are my two cents for today, and thank you so much for listening. I sincerely appreciate it yet again. If you'd like to subscribe, I am actually writing an ebook, and I would love to give it to you. So if you would like that, if you'd like to subscribe, and also I'm going to offer some other perks. I have those in the works. I'm working on it, so I want to give my listeners something in return as a thank you for listening to me, because it's all a journey, and I'm happy to have you with me. So if you wish, please text WhatsApp. Excuse me. Please text WhatsApp. WATTSUP 22828. WhatsApp 22828, and I will send you a free ebook. I'm not done with it yet, so give me a minute to do it. But I will send that to you, and I will have some other perks that I'm happy to give to any people who subscribe. Thank you again for listening. You have an awesome day. Take care now.